Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river do we recreate ourselves. What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Shar and Trev, who came up with this idea. Today's V-Wave podcast is with Aaron Olson. And I'll ask you, Aaron, to tell us a little bit about your outdoor recreation experience and your thoughts about rec.gov, which is the topic today. So welcome, Aaron.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. I am Aaron Olson. I live in Murray, Utah. I am a 48-year-old daddy of two young children, youngest daughter, 5, and my son is 10, and I'm married. And we recreate in a few different ways. We go camping, river rafting, motorcycles, and bicycles. And, you know, on multiple levels of that recreation, we intersect with rec.gov, but primarily with the boating and rafting.
Hey, Aaron, did you grow up recreating outdoors? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in the Salt Lake City area, okay. And we have lots of outdoor stuff available. My family was immediate family was not that interested in recreating outside other than a few picnics and different things.
Okay.
But my extended family, some cousins and some uncles and things, were very much into outdoors and hiking and mountain biking and river running. And eventually I got to do a bit of all those things through my relationship with some cousins and uncles.
Okay. And then out of high school, when did you start doing a lot of recreating on your own?
Yeah, probably about that time. When I left high school, I took a different path. I went into an apprenticeship program and became a plumber.
Okay.
And at that time, started earning some money. And I would buy things like, Jeeps and kayaks and mountain bikes. And then I got a passport. I didn't leave the country till a little bit later in life, in my 20s. And about that time, I started doing stuff outside in the mountains and away from civilization a little bit.
Okay. So your introduction to a permit system to recreate on federal lands would have been in this time?
No, much later. Most of the stuff I did at that time would have been non-permitted daily trips.
Okay.
Real short kind of fun things, or things that are just real out of bounds of any state parks, or mostly BLM type properties. It wasn't until I became a family person and kind of narrowed my range a little bit to accommodate the entire family, the kids and my wife and mm-hmm. everybody. And then we started running into reservation needs for campsites and, in particular, rafting permits.
And where did you first start rafting with your family? And does your wife enjoy rafting? And do your kids enjoy it?
Yeah, well, my wife did not enjoy kayaking, which is what we started doing that together before kids. And okay. We didn't do a whole lot of, inflatable type boating until my kids were born, and I'd spent some time motorcycling and bicycling, And when the kids were real little, it felt just a little too selfish for me to disappear for, 10, 12 hours at a time and not see the kids. And so
sure.
We went looking for something we could all enjoy together at the same time.
Cool.
And river running, in particular rafting, is a very good fit for that. Everybody likes it, and we're together, and it's enjoyable for everybody at the same time.
Exactly. And where did you start boating?
So primarily, again, short trips. And it was an uncle of mine that invited us out. But we mostly started on the Moab Daily sections.
Okay.
In Moab, Utah. And then again on this Green River, the conversation that brought us together on the Green River A, B, and C sections out of Dutch John. And, we've done some stuff up in Idaho, really kind of rivers that are family friendly. San Juan, different sections of different rivers, lots of times dailies. And occasionally once, twice, good years, three times we can find a way to do overnight type trips.
Okay. And have you been on into a meander canyon there from Green River, Utah, down to Mineral Bottom?
No, we have not done that section.
Okay.
We've been to Mineral Bottom, but we haven't paddled from upriver to Mineral Bottom.
Yeah, folks, it's another very, very family-friendly journey if you're outside of the mosquito season. High water can be a little challenging to make your landings, but not too bad. And certainly in the spring and fall, it's very nice for kids.
We'll add it to the list.
Yeah, yeah, do that. So certainly the Moab Daily, it's not a permit section, but the San Juan is, and you mentioned that, and the Green River, the ABC section, which is between Flaming Gorge Dam and the National Park Service's Dinosaur National Monument, which includes Lidore and Whirlpool and Split Mountain Canyons, that section. When did you first get into the ABC and run that world?
Oh, it was probably 6 or 7 years ago,
Okay.
And I'd already got, some boating equipment, enough to do an overnight. And this uncle that's gotten me into it, John, took us up there. And the system that he showed me was a really elegant system, I thought. It's the one that anyone that's gone up there is familiar with. You kind of cross your fingers, load up the trailer, and haul the rafts up to Dutch John, and then run down to Little Hole, and there's a famous whiteboard that you look and find a free spot to write your name on for a camping site. And that's the way I learned to do it. You find the campsite, you arrange a shuttle, and typically the following morning you're off on a short overnight or a couple night trip down the river. To be honest, we've never had any trouble reserving that way. Even weekends, we weren't too particular about which site we got, just happy to have one, and we were lucky enough to always get one that way.
Okay, so this is the B section you're talking about, is that right?
Yes, sir. The campground's in the B section of that. And I think we have stayed in some campgrounds outside the B section, in the C section. And they've been nice, too. A little bit more hard to find.
Okay.
And a lot further downstream. But they're nice, too. But I think the big change is coming to this B section of the Green River there.
So did you ever launch at Spillway Ramp and float through A to get to B?
We have floated through A almost every time to get to B, and then typically camped on B, and on longer trips, an additional camp on C.
Okay, I want to take a little diversion here because I've got a question about this. A section, to run the A section, you have to launch at the Spillway Ramp, which has a 15-minute time limit. I'm imagining you and your wife and your children with a raft to be loaded up and getting out and downstream. How do you handle that 15-minute time limit?
Well, the first time I did it, it wasn't handled well by me. I was not as prepared as I should have been on the above the ramp. And when we did go to unload, we do a reasonable job of taking the boat off the trailer, but all the gear for camping and stuff was... we extended past our 15 minutes, and a lot of folks let us know about it, too.
Okay.
And we apologized and explained to them that we weren't that experienced.
What time of the day was that?
That time, I think we were trying to get off a little bit earlier, so probably 8:30 or 9.
Oh, so it would have been...
Come to find out is peak, maybe not the best time.
Peak launch time.
We probably made a few fishermen upset that day, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, speaking for myself, I'm glad you were there with your family, doing such
you.
A wonderful adventure. And
we've improved on that ramp technique. One, now we wait until about... We wait until about 10, and two, we're much more prepared for an expedited exit off the ramp. And we kind of just unload a bunch of our stuff on the side there out of the way and unload the boat and then take the truck off the ramp and finish packing up off the side there.
Oh, okay, that's a very nice way of doing that. So you go down with all your stuff. You've got 15 minutes to basically unload. And you get the boat in the water, and you unload all your stuff off to the side, tie the boat up, and then drive up, get the vehicle out of there.
Yes, sir.
And then you can take your time loading up.
Yeah, we learned that the hard way. That's probably the easiest way to manage, you know, a camping type trip that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, this is helpful to know, because that's a lovely section, and until... we can move the powers that be to deal with this 15-minute crazy time frame. I understand that, you know, between 8:30 and 9 in the morning, but 10 o'clock, 11, 2 in the afternoon, really?
Yeah, so, it likely should be situational.
yeah. Well, you know, it's a matter of just talking to people. I think there's people in the agency that get it, and so maybe we'll see some change there down the road. Okay. So you would launch at Spillway and then float through A and arrive at B mid-afternoon looking for a place to camp.
Yes, sir. And in fact, looking for the camp you signed up for. So
right.
You'd be looking for a specific camp. And if you have even the simplest map, that B section is very well marked. And you'd almost have to be asleep to miss it.
Okay. Nice. When did that change for you?
Well, we recently have done that section as recent as 2 weeks ago, so that would have been about the middle of August this year, 2023, and they were still using their system of the whiteboard.
Okay.
And the ramp and everything had the same situation we just discussed. But I understand, actually through your post on Utah Paddlers, that camping arrangements about to change, and you're going to have to sign up on the rec.gov site.
Right. This is a...
We may very well have run our last trip the old way.
Okay. You're making reference to a Ashley National Forest press release that came out a couple of days ago, saying that the assigned campsites are going to be transitioned to rec.gov. And that was posted out on the Facebook group, Utah Rafters and Paddlers, or...
I believe that's
right.
That's
right. Have you used rec.gov before for any of your outdoor recreation?
Yeah, mostly we've tried to use it, but we, you know, my wife and I and a few of us that try to go on these trips together use it to sign up for the... annual permit lotteries, and then also we've tried to reserve sites, river sites, and other sites, you know, traditional camping sites on rec.gov for you know, even just pull up auto camping or that sort of thing.
Okay.
So yeah, we've had some success and some failure, but the hardest part for us is having things available with the limited amount of free time that we have.
Mm-hmm.
To match our time off with the availability of the sites, and then being fast enough or computer savvy enough to be one of the lucky few that get assigned those things. So
right.
Yeah, we've had some experience and some successes, but mostly failures in trying to negotiate that world.
This is really interesting. That whiteboard that the Forest Service set up for that section, ABC, didn't do any advertising, didn't try to reach out to people. It was just there. And you kind of had to have a little skin in the game. You kind of had to know it was there and how that system worked. And you might be able to get that off the Ashley National Forest website. You know, you have to sign up for this campsite, these campsites in this B section, and you have to do it here. This is where you can, you know, where you have to go to sign up.
That's true. And I always, obviously, we live within 3.5 hours of that whiteboard, so it's a commitment, but not as big a commitment as someone else may have to make. But I always admired the simplicity of it. And then, like I say, for us, we never had a time when we weren't able to get a site.
Right.
But yeah, the simplicity, and I know that it doesn't work for everybody, but that system there worked really well for us.
Well, that's a real good point you make for me and Flagstaff. To drive up there is a day and a half drive, mm-hmm. comfortably. Is that, you know, what's that board going to be like when I get there? And if it's full, well, I'm in trouble.
That is true.
And you know, it's, so there's a number of things that I'm looking at here. I like simplicity, as you mentioned. Simplicity is nice. How does it work for all of us? And, you know, you with your family and your cousins and your uncles know full well that we haven't done real well at building another ABC section or another Green River or another Gates of Lodore or anything else. We only have one of those. But we seem to be, you know, populations going up and up and up.
Yes, sir.
So the demand for these types of recreational activities is going up and up and up. If you had the magic permitting wand and could build any kind of system you wanted, what would be your ideal permit system? How would it work? Have you thought about that at all?
And you're talking about extending over all the permitted rivers, not just the reservations on the Green River.
Well, that's a really good question you're asking me back, which makes me think about the uniqueness of each of these river sections. I mean, the ABC is not the San Juan, is not the Moab Daily, is not Meander Canyon or what you boat up in Idaho. These are unique sections. So let me refine my question back to you, which is a real good one you've pushed back to me. Okay, Aaron. If you were the Ashley National Forest permit manager for the ABC section, how would you do it?
That's a good question. I do think if there was a fair way to make reservations and police the reservations in a way that people would not take advantage of you know, their ability to sign up and pay for a site and then never use it, never let it go unused or not put it back on some sort of standby list. That would be nice, but I'm not sure what kind of resource it would take to monitor each campsite every single day throughout the, you know, peak season. For me, the whiteboard was working well, but I understand that may not be the best for every circumstance,
mm-hmm.
And it may limit, you know, to a certain extent, the type of distance that people would be willing to drive and the type of commitment they might make. But there's lots of limits on all sorts of wilderness, and we overcome as many as we can, you know, the fundamentals like being physically able
mm-hmm.
to do those things. And then even there's a financial limit for sure on all these things. You
right.
have to have a certain level of finance. And so the last great barrier is going to be overcoming permitting and limiting of these resources. And that's a good question on how to do it best. I think in this section, the system they had seemed, you know, just from one person's perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah, yeah, I totally understand.
I've been there on the weekends, you know, and busy weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there in the middle of the week. And like I say, we've never not been able to sign up for a campground with the old whiteboard system.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure somebody has been disappointed in that system.
Okay.
But I can't speak to that because it wasn't us. I kind of thought they could leave that system as it was until it was obvious it wasn't working.
Okay.
And if it isn't working, it was not obvious to me.
Right.
Because it was working for us.
Okay, okay.
But, you know, as far as what might work, I know what doesn't work is the things where you are able to sign up way in advance
mm-hmm.
for a site that you have maybe some good intentions of using, but, you know, sometimes don't get used and don't get put back in a way that people understand that they might be available for a drive-up or a standby or something like that, and how you fix that is beyond anything that I can really understand. As far as enforcing people that, you know, don't turn in their permits if they're not looking to use them, and people that, you know, kind of hoard sites or sign up for all sorts of days and with the intention of using one or maybe two of those dates and then giving them
back.
Oh,
interesting.
And then just, you know, and for me in particular, I'm not around computers most of the time. I'm working with my hands and tools, and
mm-hmm.
there's other people like me, but I know there's a lot of people that are around a computer all day long, but it's very difficult for me to be in a position to sign up for a certain river site or a river permit on a given morning when I don't have that stuff readily available. And things tend to happen so fast online, and I don't know exactly how.
Right.
But me and most folks like me are not able to get those quick-hitting permits or camp reservations as fast as it seems like some other people are able to. You know, I don't know if it needs to be a lottery that, you know, maybe removes people for a little while after they've had an opportunity of using a certain place, or if there should be some consideration to folks that live within a certain proximity or local to a certain river, which is important for those of us without a lot of time off, that, you know, we're able to use the things that are near our homes.
Right.
But it's also, you know, I guess important for people that live a little bit further out to have an opportunity to see different things too. So that's a way of answering things from a place where I'm looking at it, which
mm-hmm.
is a pretty limited view, likely.
Well, your view, you share a lot of commonalities with a lot of people. I think a lot of people who recreate, as you pointed out, understand they need to be physically able and they need to be financially able. It sounds like you recognize that we do need to limit the number of people in these places and permits. The number of available permits is a way to do that, to preserve the experience that everybody would like to have on the river. Not be, you know, not run into a zillion people and be unable to find a place to camp, and when you want to stop at an attraction site, it's completely overrun with people. It would be nice to have a not too crowded experience, which is what most people go out and recreate for. I could be wrong in putting words in your mouth here, so jump back if I am.
I'll let you know, but so far I'm in agreement.
Okay. There certainly are busy weekends. There are busy midweek times, too. One of the things that you're touching on here is a cancellation disincentive. I mean, there are disincentives throughout recreating, whether it's an age disincentive or a financial disincentive, or you don't have the permit. That's a big disincentive. Can't go then. Whether you've got the money or and you've got the physical strength to do it or not. But you're exactly right. It seems like the problem here is if somebody says, "Well, I'm gonna book," I'm gonna it's only a small fee, and so I'm going to pay a certain amount to kind of capture a certain number of permits, and I'm gonna figure out what I'm gonna do. And if there's no incentive to cancel those permits, or I have a permit, but the more I look into it, the more I realize, oh, I'm going to have to drive from Boston to a Dutch John, which I was told was a really cool place, but the more I look at it, I got to drive all the way there, and I got to get a boat and a life jacket and all this other sort of stuff. Wow, I don't know about that. I'm going to bail.
Mm-hmm.
Well, rec.gov takes the money for the application, so they're happy. They don't care. But the people who recreate do care, because there's a campsite that somebody was supposed to be at, but there's nobody there. Now, there may be a good reason for that. They may have had an automobile accident. They may have choked on their hamburger in Dutch John. I mean, there's any number of reasons for that. But it may be that a month or two earlier, the person just decided, well, I'm going to go someplace else and do something else.
That's the fear that I have, and even in just these big river permits, too. I mean, I know that there's a certain way that you can police things, but, scheduling days before you're going to show up at a place, scheduling a campsite for 2 or 3 days when your intention is to spend one night.
Right.
Those sorts of things, just in order to secure a site, and the abuses of a system, and then just the difficulty or impossible leasing a system fairly, and
right,
having to look into each individual situation,
yep,
as to why they were unable to make it to their campsite, and then making a judgment call of whether that excuse is a valid excuse or an invalid excuse and then penalizing someone for an invalid excuse, and then somehow keeping track of the penalty and enforcing some sort of penalty on folks is a very difficult proposition.
Right. And not penalizing someone who has a legitimate reason.
Right.
'Cause life happens. And especially, the most dangerous thing we're going to do with river running is drive to the put-in and drive home. And so things can happen on that journey, and they do occasionally.
Sure.
But you're bringing up a real good point, which is the complexity of a system. So you have a cancellation system that says, okay, 2 months out, we're going to get in touch with you to see if you're still going. And 1 month out, we're going to get in touch with you to see if you're still going. And if you cancel when you're 2 months out or 1 month out, you get some sort of demerits. The closer you get to launch, the more the disincentives appear for canceling. Because ideally what you'd like to do when you issue a permit is actually help people get to the put-in. And so, when somebody finally gets a permit, what can the agency do, or what can rec.gov do to help these people get to the put-in and have a good journey, instead of trying to figure out ways to make sure they're not gaming the system and kick them out? Or maybe you need to do both, I don't know. Incentives and disincentives, you'd really like the people who get a permit to actually have a good time at the resource.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, and this is just something I thought of, and it probably has some disadvantages, but I don't know if having to put some money up front to secure that position, a larger sum, and then having part or all of that money is rebated when you actually show up to execute the permit and refunded to an account of some kind, so some sort of escrow.
Right.
But then again, you know, we're adding a lot of complexity to an already complex situation. But then you don't know, you know, how much money is a barrier to people for needless cancellations, and then how high is that money to where regular folks ain't going to be able to, you know, front a bit of money waiting for their trip. And
that's
those,
right.
Those are all things that are beyond my level, but I'm sure there's something somewhere along those lines that may work.
That's a really good point. You say, well, we're gonna Minor Tillotson back in 1937 told the French trio who were gonna kayak from Green River, Wyoming, out to Lake Mead down by the Hoover Dam, basically told them they would need to put up in today's money over $100,000 bond.
Yeah.
To float through Grand Canyon, because he was sure they would need a rescue. And so he'd say, okay, well, that Tillotson had the idea, we'll have people put up a $100,000 bond. Well, that'll shear off a whole bunch of people, so those permits ought to be available. Wow, is that the way we're heading here? That you know, there are hurdles there that only so many people can jump.
That's true.
So we want to be careful with that. And then you also mentioned...
And we're already jumping a lot of hurdles just to get to the point where we're able to plan and execute a trip like that.
Correct. That's right. And we've touched upon some of them here. And as you say, okay, I'm going to have to cancel my permit. Hopefully that permit goes right back out into a cancellation pile where people can see it. But
right.
that helps the short-timers, the immediate people, who have the flexibility and don't need the long-term planning horizon to say, hey, there's a Grand Canyon permit to raft the Grand Canyon. It launches in 5 days or three. Do you want it? Shall we go? Well, there's only a certain subset of people that can jump that fast and that high.
Right, and even then, it's still such a limited and coveted trip that access, and this is, you know, access to technology and immediate time off and planning, and so different folks with different sort of lifestyles and financial situations and the ability to quickly maneuver time off from employment or other things, and they'll be at an advantage, but somebody's always going to have some advantage no matter the system, likely.
That's right. But the question is how to design a system that works for a family of four, a working family of four, that likes to recreate out of doors, that is trying to hold down a business, run a business. I'm talking about you, Aaron. Because
I recognize that guy. Yeah,
I think it's important for this system to work equally for you as it works for someone who is maybe in the gig economy, available to step in and out of a job with a huge amount of flexibility. It would seem as though the best permit situation would be receptive to all users and not sort of start shearing people out.
Yeah.
The bottom line is even a system that was fair to all users and equitable and was able to deal with cancellations squarely. Would still be overrun with the supply being well outstripped by the demand.
Right.
But still, it seems as though it's our duty to try to come up with systems that are fair and equitable for all users, whether they win or lose.
I agree. And if some consideration could be given to folks that live in a certain proximity, not so much that we're lucky enough to live here, but just to cut down on certain travel times to certain rivers regionally, if there was a consideration for folks that, you know, if you live within 400 miles of a certain place, maybe they got a special allotment just for those people. It could take a trip, you know, that might take somebody from a greater distance, two or three weeks, which makes it impossible for a working family to something that might be done in 7, 9, 10 days, you know, more locally.
Let me make sure
I don't know that there's any consideration for, you know, regional use.
Let me make sure
permitting.
I understand you here. I live in Flagstaff, Arizona, and so if I drive 70 miles, I'm at the Grand Canyon. If I drive 120, I'm at the Put-In, at Lee's Ferry. Are you suggesting I should have an extra bonus, if you will, for living here and being so close to this resource?
And I don't think exclusive rights are fair, you know, obvious, but I think that maybe have a reserved set of reservations, and not just because you're lucky enough to live there, which is, you know, probably you are, but those, as far as financially and time away from, you know, family life and work, the closer you are to something, you know, you can shorten your distance of getting there and the expense and the time away from work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had just a, you know, if you were only competing, you know, for an allotted number of permits to, say, somebody that lived within 400 or 600 miles of a certain place, I'm not sure that that's fair, but it certainly would work for people in my circumstance.
Right. And so then that would beg the question, saying, okay, if there are X number of permits per day for a certain reach that you live the Goldilocks distance from, what percentage of those permits would go to the people that live nearby? And what would justify that percent? I mean, I don't know. I don't have the answers here. I'm just kicking it out.
Well, especially on something like the Grand Canyon. I mean, obviously someone, it's a special trip for most folks. Even though there are a lot of people who've been down that stretch a lot of time. Even though it doesn't seem fair, it would certainly be nice for folks like me that don't have to, you know, maybe we could get a permit in, Washington State or something like that, but, you know, we can't afford to drive that far or miss that much time off work.
And, mm-hmm.
But we could get a campground on the green pretty easy and make a, you know, midweek or a weekend of it.
Right.
And I know it isn't fair, but to localize things and regionalize things in a limited way, you know, I think that would maybe help out folks in my particular situation.
You know, Aaron, you're making me think that distance in itself is one of these limits. We mentioned physical ability and financial, but distance away.
Oh, it's a barrier. I think it is a barrier, yeah.
It's a barrier already. So the people who live nearby maybe don't necessarily realize how lucky they are. So I kind of wonder if that limit is already built in, a distance limit.
It certainly keeps us from making certain trips we might otherwise do, you know, further away from us. So I'm sure that
so that's an inherent disincentive that's built into the sport. Okay, I'm going to put my boat in the pickup truck and I'm going to drive it to Alaska to run the Toshin Shini. I'm going to drill a hole in my boat unless I really pad it well in the truck. I'd much rather, you know, drive up there and rent the boat than bang my poor little boat all the way up there.
And those folks that live up there, they should have some sort of special access to a river like that.
Right.
I think, I mean, mm-hmm, I know that mm-hmm. it's not equal.
Right.
And it might not even be fair, but maybe it's right. I don't know.
Right. That's a really interesting point to consider and ponder. Do the locals get a percentage increase? If you're a local, then you get 2 points in the lottery or some sort of preference instead of someone who's further away, which might get 1 point. Then I would say probably a lot of people that are further away would want to meet people like you and say, Aaron, buddy, old pal, put in a permit for me or something so that we can, it might open up more places for people to game a system.
Possibly. Yeah,
and
right.
And systems can be gamed one way or another. The more complex systems, the more complex the gaming. It's a bugger. I would really be interested in coming back and visiting with you again. Between now and then, I would really be interested in your pondering this and thinking about ways to come up with a better mousetrap, a better system, because maybe a plumber in Murray, Utah is going to come up with the concept to make this work that is fair, equitable, doesn't give anybody an unnecessary leg up, and helps us all in the world of permits feel like it's fair. And right now, I don't get that feeling from people I'm talking to.
No, I don't think that it's fair either. But and I can think about it and come up with my solution. More likely to come up with the things we know are wrong.
Okay, that's a start.
But that's okay. We'll make a few mistakes and hopefully refine something to something that's more workable for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I would certainly encourage you to stay close to this issue. You are a local to that wonderful section of river, and it would be great to get, I think for the agency to get your comments on what works and what doesn't work, and to basically have this discussion we've just had with them.
For sure. Certainly. And what I'll do is, I'm just speculating on past experience and putting it into what I think might happen on this ABC section of the green. But we'll definitely try the system when it's online, and we'll have an idea of what type of system it is for people like us, and we can have another discussion for sure.
That would be awesome, Aaron. I would appreciate that. Great. Well, with that, let's conclude this V-Wave with Aaron Olson. I really appreciate your taking the time today to visit with me, Aaron. And my name is Tom Martin, and thank you so very much.
Thank you.